Great. Welcome everyone to the March 2023 meeting of the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee. Please note that this is a public meeting and it is recorded. That includes us on video, sound, and things in the chat. So please do be mindful of that. I'm going to go ahead and start by calling roll. If you can please unmute yourself and verbally indicate that you are here or if you're in person, if you can press your mic there so that we can be sure the recording picks it up. Ashley Miller. Ashley let us know that she will be joining, but is a few minutes late today. Rachel Messi. Thanks, Rachel. Hello. Alan Lazo.
Good afternoon, everyone. Alan Lazo, present by video, virtual.
Great, thanks, Alan. Barbara Geyer.
Here, in person.
Barbara. Yung Ho.
Hello. Let me see my camera here. Yes, I am joining virtually.
Wonderful, okay. Thank you, yeah. Holly Stevens.
Hello, I'm here.
So is there any more clarity?
Hi. Jamila Rutherford. Rutherford, sorry, Jay, I always do that. I don't believe Jay is with us. Mara Romero.
Here in person.
Thank you, Mara. And Fanny Adams.
Hi, everyone, joining virtually.
Hi, Fanny. All right, thank you so much. So we do not have quorum today. Please do keep that in mind that FPAC will not be able to vote or make any policy recommendations as we do not have quorum. The agenda is up here on the screen. Thank you, Ryan. We have a few staff updates that I will cover for you. And then Dr. Krishnan is going to take us over the low income household analysis, our first section of analysis for the Portland Fair Housing Plan. We have 15 minutes set aside for public comment, and we do have a few folks signed up today, so we may need a little bit more time, but we can push in if we need to. And then we're going to wrap up today's meeting with a conversation led by your committee person, Mara Romero, around public comment as part of her work on the Community Engagement Subcommittee. One moment to share screen. For the staff updates, because it's been a while since I saw you all. I have some staff updates. The first item of the update regards City Bureau assignments. Now, this update was originally slotted for January and this had just happened, so apologies if this is old news, but just to ensure that we're all on the same page. The city bureaus have been reassigned to different commissioners, and that happened in January. Bureaus were clustered and reassigned in preparation for the charter reform transitions and moving to a city administrator. The Portland Housing Bureau was previously under Commissioner Dan Ryan's portfolio, but we are now assigned to Commissioner Carmen Rubio. We are clustered together as the Community and Economic Development Cluster. That includes the Bureau of Development Services, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, as well as Prosper Portland. The goal of this is to streamline our Bureau functions and integrate any city-offered services across this grouping. So I wanted to make you all aware of that. Next item is regarding our new appointments. You may see some new faces today on the meeting. Commissioner Rubio approved the candidates we had selected for this committee. Yay! And hopefully that takes care of the quorum issues that we've been experiencing lately. So I am very excited. That appointment report was approved by City Council last week on March 8th. The official term for them does begin April 1st because it's following that quarterly meeting schedule. And our six new committee persons are all listed there. Irina Alonso, Olia Goralkina, Stephanie Gracie, Caroline Jackson, Jesse Nielsen, and Christina Dirks. Some of them are joining as members of the public today. Welcome. Their first official meeting as committee persons will be next month at our April 11th meeting. We'll do a round of introductions for the new folks, as well as our existing committee folks, so that everyone has a chance to get to know each other a little bit. Also to update, this is quite dated by now, but Taylor Smiley Wolf has resigned from the committee. She resigned in December. She has moved on from Home Forward and is working in the governor's office. We want to thank her for her work on FHAC and appreciate everything that she did for the subcommittee development as well. And good luck to Taylor, and thank you. The next update is in regards to Fair Housing Month, which is in April. Every year in April, Alan lights up. Every year we celebrate Fair Housing Month, and we do that with a proclamation at City Council. We do have that scheduled this year for Wednesday, April 5th. We've had a few shifts in time, so I will send that out to you once it's settled down a little bit. But if you would like to stream it or attend in person, you are welcome to, and I'll make sure to get that information to you. The Fair Housing Council of Oregon will present the area winners of their 25th annual poster contest. And Alan Lazo, your fellow committee person, will also give some remarks, in addition to city commissioners, the mayor, and our interim bureau director, Molly Rogers. The final update, I'm gonna drink a water because it's a big one, is in regards to the affirmatively furthering fair housing proposed rules. So I sent you all out an email last month now, I believe it's at the beginning of February, that kind of described this, but I just wanted to touch upon it again today, that in January, HUD had announced their new proposed rules for the Fair Housing Act's affirmatively furthering fair housing mandate, and they posted those rules and it entered the public comment period. So as we are all familiar, but I'll refresh our memories. We used to have the analysis of impediments to fair housing. We had the assessment of fair housing, and that's one of the primary work topics of this committee, with those rules done away with for a while by the federal government. We have entered into our voluntary Portland Fair Housing Plan while we've waited for a signal like this from the new administration. And we have been anticipating it, but it has taken much more form over the last few months. So I had linked those rules for you all to review, but the highlights are that it does reinstate and simplify a required fair housing analysis for program participants, which is jurisdictions such as the City of Portland and Multnomah County and City of Gresham. It does aim to increase transparency for public review and comment. It aims to increase accountability for fair housing policies, recommendations, and strategies that are identified through that fair housing analysis. And under those new rules, Portland and other jurisdictions in partnership and all folks that are receiving those program funds from HUD would submit an equity plan. That's the new name of that fair housing analysis. It's now called an equity plan, to HUD every 5 years with an annual progress evaluation submitted every year. So that is still in the public comment period, and public comments are due by April 10th, and then we'll see what changes may arise out of that, and I will keep you updated as developments come. I also sent out draft public comment language that the Bureau was planning to submit to HUD. Thank you for the committee members that participated in giving me feedback. I very much appreciate it. And maybe you or your organizations independently also submitted public feedback. Our public comment was signed by the Bureau Interim Director Molly Rogers, and it is currently being submitted by the Office of Government Relations. It is pretty much very similar to the draft that you saw, and once we have an official copy, I will post that on our website and also send it out to you. Thank you, Alan. Yes, there's the policy link guide. I think don't know if I sent that one. I sent out another guide as well. If you're still interested, I'm happy to connect you to resources on how to draft public comment if you're interested in doing that as well. Until new rules are officially adopted, FHAC, we can continue on our path to develop our Portland Fair Housing Plan, and then sections can be adopted and incorporated as appropriate. Once, you know, the rule process is completed at HUD, we can revisit that, but I just wanted to let you know that, you know, the pieces that we are looking at today can be incorporated into those plans as appropriate. Okay. That is all I have for staff updates today. Next on our agenda, we have the low income household analysis, and it will be presented primarily by Dr. Uma Krishnan. The agenda does list Bimal Rajvindari, and of course we'd like to credit his work here, but he was unfortunately not able to join today's meeting and the presentation. In our last few meetings, we've continued to work on our Portland Fair Housing Plan and review those several pieces of general demographic summary to start us off. Our next phase starts today, where we begin working through each of those identified areas of analysis that we discussed and listed out last year to include in the plan. So that brings us to today's presentation, where we're going to focus on low-income households in Portland. Before we begin, I will let Dr. Krishnan briefly introduce herself.
Sure. I hope you are able to hear me. Good afternoon. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Oh, that's all that's needed. Good afternoon. I'm Uma, and I'm so pleased to see a few faces that I've worked with in the past. And I will not spend time naming them, but I'm really happy, and the work around fair housing couldn't be more important. I know this whole analysis of impediment just seems so drawn out, but it's just that I think the more we look at it, it's convincing that we have to keep at it for the place to unfair practices to become fair. And so we have this presentation, 18, 19 slides, which is all about use of CHAS data. But before I begin the presentation, it's a happy day for the data team. It's the Pi Day. So happy Pi Day. And we do have, for the in-person folks, we have a bunch of pie out there, and we'll be honored if you can go and grab yourself a piece. And for others, it's rain check. And we do miss our colleague Bimal, but he's doing his civic duty. He's doing jury duty. So I'll be covering some of his spatial slides, and I might miss some of the things because he has been looking at, and you have all seen the presentation, but he has been looking at the maps, which are, meaning if you really dig into them, they are revealing of patterns and, you know, areas of concentrations and things. But we can definitely, we'll take your questions and revisit those if I'm not able to adequately answer those. So I'm going to turn it over to Nikki so that she can go over the general intent of the presentation.
Yes, this is the outline of the presentation. First, we're going to discuss CHAS data and why it is useful. Overall information on the number of low-income households in our community, and then their tenure by renter or owner, as well as the spatial distribution of where these households live, as Uma just touched on. There are quite a few maps which illustrate that spatial distribution in a variety of different ways. We've got one including only by income, by cost burden households, and by tenure. Next slide, please. So what is CHAS data? CHAS is an acronym which stands for Comprehensive Housing Affordability Strategy. And it is a specially tabulated data set which HUD receives from the Census Bureau. It is based on the American Community Survey, which is called ACS data, and it generally lags behind our other data sets. Our most recent data set is from the 2015 to 2019 period, so that's what you'll see being used today. It is particularly useful because it demonstrates housing needs and problems, particularly for low-income households, and it provides us estimates of the number of households in various categories, such as by race and ethnicity or disability status. We are also required to use this data set for the housing needs analysis. So we just want to highlight this for you so that you can understand that the source data for today's presentation is different than what we've been looking at when we went through those demographic summaries, and to let you know that there is a noted lag in the publishing of the most current versions of those data sets. So again, we are going to be looking up to the 2019 year, with that most recent data set being 2015 to 2019. Next slide, please.
Okay, so we were in the midst of coordinating. And CHAS, some of you may have all, you may be familiar with it, but the CHAS data, the Comprehensive Housing Affordability Strategy, it's really significant and important as it ties to the HUD and its fund. So anytime we do the five-year consolidated plan, this analysis is really important because then we start looking at, you know, the extent of need. You know, it tells us how many, not just low-income household, but we group them in this continuum, extremely low, very low, low, and you probably you all know that up to 80 MFI, they fall in the low-income category, and then we have 1,800 who are moderate, and then the high-income folks. So the first slide here is just to give you an idea on the income limits we are talking about, and this is the area median income, and sometimes we use it interchangeably with the MFI median family income. This is for 2019 and it's by household size. So if you look at the, and for some of these tables that I have, we have highlighted the interesting facts around it. So in 2019, a four-person household making, you know, just over $25,000 a year qualifies as extremely low income household. And at the same time, like you look at the you're looking at the same household size, four person were making like well over 2.5, meaning 2.5 times $70,300 for the 80% limit. So they also fall on in the low income continuum. And this may have come up, I don't know when we, this is probably my third presentation with the council, maybe the first or second one, this whole impact of stringent definitions which do not fit the realities on the ground. And I, at this time, I'm not sure what we do about it, but if we talk enough about it, you know, we can make this change. But just the continuum, you're beginning to look at, you just call them extremely low income, but we are talking income of 25,000 or 26,000. And then we can go up to 70,000 and a little bit more, and they're still in the low income category, and they could, you know, they can qualify for HUD programs. So this in itself presents a challenge. So this slide is, it's a distribution, and we're looking at the city level, and this is for 2019 in terms of the share of various households. So the largest pie, there you go, the pie, the household income with greater than 100 MFI, they're at 46%. So that means 54%, they are in this other, you know, the other side of the pie. But I think it's really important to note that if you take out that green slice, which is the moderate income household, 80 to 100, 44% actually fall in that low income. So we are talking about a city, literally half and half. You know, idea would have been that green, the slice of the green be much higher, and you know, probably the extremely low income, 16%. That's quite a bit. So I think where today's analysis kind of heading is, we're talking about a significant share of the households in the city who actually fall in the low income continuum, and at the same time, there is just about half, you know, 46% who are making high income. So there is that inherent you know, polarization at the two ends. So the next slide talks about the number and nature of low-income households. And we kind of go back to, because this the last plan we did was, 2011, and a lot has changed since then. But if you just look at the number, that in itself is telling. So if you look at the extremely low-income household, that grew at 12%, which is much higher than the rate of the growth of households in the city as a whole. That's close to 8%. It's slightly different from what you may have seen in ACS, and my recollection is about 10%, but that's much more current, and this is 2019. And so this clearly tells that, you know, our shares, the city of Portland's share of households that fall in the extremely low-income household has grown. We have, as of today, it's close to just over 42,000 households who are extremely low-income, and we're talking incomes of 25,000 for a family of four. Clearly, they don't have the resources, and it's a significant barrier. The next slide is on the tenure, and we're talking about owners and renters, and the light blue is we're talking about owners and the total share of owners, and the share is along the column that, you know, if you're talking about 100 renters, 60% of the renters are actually households with greater than 100 AMI. It all makes sense. Whereas if you look at the lowest share, it's the extremely low income households who are not owners. You know, we're talking just about 7.2%, and possible they became owners way back when the city was actually affordable. Must have been way before 1990 or something. But I have highlighted two other shares, and we're talking, we are beginning to talk renters now. And if you look at the extremely low income, we have about 25% who are actually renters. So we are talking 32,000 renter households. And at the same time, we have households that make about 100,000. So 28-29% of them are actually renters. And clearly they are able to make this choice. And I don't want to get into this whole discussion of what the market might be doing. And is it then producing units that are much more within the reach of higher income household? But clearly there is this phenomenon that we have 25% households who would not get the choice and likely are renters, not necessarily because of the choice. And then we have 25% who are actually renters, and they have made this choice, and likely the market is responding to that need, which could better their margins to make things work. But I figured it's important that JAS does tell us this. It gives us this insight. Did you have a question?
I have so many questions. Okay. I have so many questions. But
okay.
You
want to take questions? I could.
The first one's kind of simple. So is AMI the same thing as MFI? Like, are the numbers the same, or?
The terms are the, what do you call it? Acronyms. They're used interchangeably. They're absolutely the same.
Okay. That was something that just was bugging me. But yeah, that was the only thing that was really important. This is also fascinating. And it really does. It's nice to see what you anecdotally see out there, like in numbers. You know what I mean? Because the units that are available right now are often more available to people who make 80% AMI or above 100. And then people are like, what are all these available units here? But obviously there are renters that are looking for them. So that's interesting. Thank you.
Uma, if we're gonna take questions, Alan had a question in the chat that I can read to you.
Sure.
The previous slide. Could you go back a slide?
Sure.
Yes, I believe it was for this one. Do we have comparisons for these income bands with national statistics or for other similar cities?
We absolutely have, Alan. I don't have them in the presentation, but we do have them because CHAZ is available at the national level and it, at the city level. And some of the data that you see, Bimal has spent quite a bit of time, because what CHAZ, if you go to the HUD page, what they do is they give us customized summary tables, but some of the other, by tenure or when we start looking at by race and ethnicity, these are, it's like 54 tables or something, very unwieldy. But if there is interest in what the nation looks like and some chosen cities, we would be able to provide that to you. And Alan, you're spot on that it would be really interesting to see. And I, without even looking at the data, I think we will not look very similar to the nation at this time, especially in terms of the share of extremely low income households, or for that matter, high income households. But you're going to see a lot of similarity in this makeup within some of these big cities, Seattle, San Francisco. We probably have Denver, which is beginning. We are all beginning to look like each other, and it'll be really interesting. Is it Green Bay, Wisconsin, that's much more affordable than any other place? So we'll be happy to get that out to you if there is interest in that.
Alan, you had your hand up. Did you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, I think it got mostly answered, but that's exactly it. I'd be interested in seeing how, particularly the comment around the high percentage of extremely low income residents that we have, how that compares to other similar cities. And I agree. I think the comment that it's higher than lots of other cities is accurate, and I think really plays into, particularly as we move forward and look at kind of where those demographics are in our city, are important. Thanks.
Can I ask one more?
Sure.
Kind of a follow-up to that, but I was wondering if CHAZ collects data on like sources of income. So like, as I'm thinking that potentially a lot of these low-income folks could be people on fixed incomes, like do they track that information?
So Mara, this is a good question for me, because what CHAZ does is it's the special tabulation. So basically it's rooted in the same set of surveys that ACS draws from. It's just that ACS is at a different level and they don't talk about this 30, 40, whatever. What census does is it takes that group of survey responses and then they start tabulating. So it does, I am fairly certain that they apply, weights to it, which is why it becomes a representative data. That's why you can say it's speaking for the city as a whole.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But it's not intentionally, it's like just being interpreted that.
Meaning it follows the principles of statistics, right?
Yeah.
And if HUD is saying that we want, these are our groupings, they give the cutoff, right? 30, 80, whatever. So the number of samples within these groups then has to be representatives. Question, they would definitely ensure that anybody, if income is driving this customization, then there is enough of a representation for everyone making that kind of income.
Got it.
Sure, question. I didn't see a slide. Was it just your comment that how Portland compares to other cities, or is there an actual slide? I don't see one. Reason I'm asking is I'm extremely familiar with California and California cities and California history. So if we talk, when I hear San Francisco, I want to know, is this something that you've documented?
You know what, Barbara, there is no slide. I was just responding to Alan. And I'm speaking from, there was a seminal paper which looked at, it's called The Shape of the Curve, and it looked at the income distribution between within various cities, and all these high-end cities at the time, this is 1990, we're talking about the San Jose's and the San Francisco's, they looked very different from Portland at the time. But I have done some computations in the subsequent decades, 2000, 2010, 2020, we are beginning to look a lot like these other places in terms of our distribution, and given the share of increase we have seen in terms of housing prices, I am inclined. I mean, I could be wrong, but I have reasonable confidence that our share is going to be close to what we may be seeing in the San Francisco or LA. You know, a little bit extreme, but if we take cities that are comparable in our to our population, you know, 600,000, a little plus, we probably will be looking close to Seattle, maybe San Francisco, give or take a little bit.
Okay, but I think you're referring to prices. Am I right? Where this is the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee, so my focus is fair housing and distributions within fair housing. And that's what I've been speaking about for all the years that I've been on this committee and before. And that's what I wanted to know.
No, I'm not referring to the income. I'm referring to the share of households who would fall in these different groups.
Exactly.
So that's what I'm referring to. And it'll be interesting. So we'll do the follow-up work and look at some of these other comparison places and see where we land in terms of share of households that were extremely low income.
So please help me out here. So I thought I heard a conversation about very low income percentages in Portland is rising. Is it also rising in San Francisco, for example?
That was my guesswork. I haven't looked at it, but I have a feeling it may have risen as well.
Okay,
and I'm thinking in terms of if you look, meaning instead of 16%, for us, it's 16% extremely low, right? For San Francisco, they may be at 18 or something. My thinking is maybe it's close. But I need to look at the data before saying it. But I'm inclined to think that when we look at this share of household, we're going to be close, I think.
Well, let's follow up with that information, just because I'm trying to keep it on.
That's true.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry. We are in person, so bear with us. So this is an illustration. It's bar chart, right? The blue is owners and the green is renters. And for the extremely low income households, 3/4 of them are actually renters. And I keep saying it's not like, you know, the plight of very low income households might be any better than extremely low, but that's where you see the most vulnerability. That's why I'm calling it out. And at the same time, you know, if you look at moderate income households, 80 to 100, just over 1/2 are homeowners. So there's going to be this, there needs to be this discussion around fair housing that when a household with less means is renter, they are much more vulnerable to housing instability as opposed to the whole ownership, and should we be thinking about that whole conversation. So this slide, Nikki, was it what you're going to do? So Nikki is thinking about it, so I might as well take it. And there's an abrupt switch. So we went from numbers and shares to what you see is a map of Portland, and it's the neighborhood analysis area, and we have 24 of them. And the reason I put it up, some of the subsequent maps do talk about, because track level with the associated margin of error can be very tricky, and when the margin of error is much higher than 10%, because all the estimates are at 90% confidence, it gets a little hard to make assertion. So this is a favorite analysis. It's not a census geography, it's analysis geography. And I'm going to put in a good word for our annual ritual. It's the state of the housing, and we've been doing it for 7-8 years. And it has a lot of data around renters and owners, and some of the data we get from CoStar, which is much more current than CHAZ or ACS. But the interesting thing is then it kind of looks at various household types by race and by, you know, composition, and we are able to, it's descriptive, but we can say, you know, that no African-American households can live in any of these neighborhoods. So that kind of speaks for the state of Portland. And some of the analysis and maps we have done is at this neighborhood analysis area. That's the reason this map is there, just to give you all some context. So this one, and I know it looks very busy, but it kind of gives an idea of the spatial distribution of rented household. This is all renters in the various income groups, you know, extremely low, very low, low, and moderate. And I think the one noteworthy thing is there may be pockets, which are highly highly concentrated, but for the most part, like extremely low income, you see there are a lot more of them east of, you know, it will be east of 82nd. That's where the darker areas are, and then as you move up the income spectrum, the map kind of shifts, and you see less of a concentration around the east. But I also wanted to point out, these are just the maps, the data, you can't see the data here, but the fact that the city has been intentional about where we put some of these affordable housing, downtown in Pearl. Pearl actually has the highest concentration of, I was just looking at that track, you know, track 51 or 52, very high concentration of households, renter households, who do not make much income. So we have made, and that shows up in these maps. Should I see that? So this is a companion map around home owners. And again, it's because we have four maps sitting up out there, it's hard to tell, focus on one story. But if you're talking about extremely low income household, and if you remember from that table, it's about 10,000 household, 7.2% or something. And most of them are actually east on the, towards the east side. And then there is also some, NOVA, naturally occurring affordable housing that may have shown up in the rental map. So for us, the spatial distribution is less, you know, these not that stark. It's like, oh, all of them are in this one place. So it's something to think about and strategize as we move forward. So this is a table that talks about the cost burden by income level, and by cost burden, if a household, you know, the marker is, which is getting outdated, no household ought to pay more than 30% of their income on rent or on mortgage. If they do more than that, they can get classified as cost burden. And then if they end up paying 50% or more, they are severely cost burden. Again, if you look at the highlighted proportions, nearly 75% of extremely low income households and very low income households, and nearly 50% of low income households are cost burden. So this substantiates the extent and the depth of need that's out there in our city. In contrast, only 25% of moderate and 6% of high income households face cost burden issues at 30%. I'm sure you all do this work, so you know, these are just numbers that substantiate what you already know and work with. So this is, again, we're going back to a couple maps. This is a spatial distribution of cost burden renters. And the darker areas have higher concentration. Renters in general happen to be cost burden. So for us, it's just that, you don't see one area that just pops up. But this one, actually, if you look down below, there is that area. I think it's the Hillsdale area, where there is some naturally. That's what Bimal had mentioned. I'm glad I remembered. there is some naturally occurring affordable rental units. This is a companion map with homeowners, and the darkest spot you see, it's the gateway neighborhood. And then, so that means a lot of cost burden homeowners living in that particular neighborhood. So this, oh, sure, Mara.
Do cost burden homeowners, is it the same idea that they're spending more than 30% of their total income on their household expenses, whether that be like their mortgage or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. It's the same measure, whether it's regardless of tenure.
Okay. Thank you.
So this this illustration, and possible, this has been aired in other venues, and for us, we find this extremely useful. So it's you would see the title as affordable housing deficit and as measured by cost burden. And this came up in the council, and our director Molly and Matt had been presented this slide, and I actually just took it from there. But it needs to be noted that the 25,000 plus households, it's unmet need, as in they are severely cost burdened. They're spending more than 50% of their income on rent. And that's why it's not that they're not housed at this time, but it's just that they're spending so much of their income on rent, it makes them, they're precariously housed. So that's the meaning here when we say deficit, and you see deficit in all the, you know, the various income categories, but at minimum you're talking about 25,000 households who are spending 50% or more of their income just on rent. So this slide is income levels by race and ethnicity. And along the first column, you see various race groups. And just to highlight, you know, if you look at, and all the rows, they need to add up to 100, because that speaks for that particular race group, like the white alone, non-Hispanic. You know, noteworthy is the fact that within various race and ethnic groups, the share of households in lower income categories appears to be disproportionately high. For instance, 39% of African American households make less than or equal to 30% AMI. In contrast, only 30% of white non-Hispanic households fall in this category, with as much as 50% having income greater than 100% AMI. Again, it's telling the same thing, that people of color and such households, they find themselves at this intersectionality. You know, they look different, they make different amounts of money, and their access to housing and various choices look very different than the white alone non-Hispanic category. This,
excuse me, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
Do you go into the why?
No, this is descriptive at this time, and the idea is, you know, just laying it out there, and you know, councils such as yours, you will take up the fair housing part, or you know, the strategic planning.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. And I hope we do.
The whys are for others, yes.
Well,
but
no.
It's really good factual data to reference, that's for sure.
I mean, not that we don't like to get into the why. We love that, but you guys are around.
I understand.
Thank you.
To lend your intellectual capital. Thank you. So this is, we're kind of getting close to the end of the presentation, and I'm not sure how well I did on time, but I do thank you for your patience. So this is a slide, it's on disability status by household income for 2019, and they have these five different groups around disabilities, meaning labels. You have household member has self-care or independent, you have a household member cognitive limitation, ambulatory limitation here on vision. And then the green, the bar at the bottom, that's the household member has none of the above limitation. And they, these are by, and the columns you see are the various income groups. And well over half, 56% of extremely poor households have one or more members with some form of disability. In comparison, less than a quarter of households with moderate to high income have members that have some form of disability. But here I do want to say, you know, looking at this data, our intent is not to let the viewer walk away thinking, you know what, if you're higher, if you have a higher income, you would, the probability that you have a disability status is highly reduced. I don't think that's the right, takeaway. It's more that if somebody, if a household has to face this disability sudden or, you know, it has been ongoing and then chronically moving towards debilitating, the chances that they fall into this, the household starts making less and less money for various reasons, less opportunities for job. They kind of reinforce each other. So I think I do want to emphasize that, but it's interesting.
I was just going to add to that, may go back to my question earlier about people on fixed incomes, like on disability benefits or on retirement or Social Security type benefits, because a lot of times you can't earn over a certain amount or else you become ineligible. So that's more the why, but it would be nice to understand better, you know, more deeply what's going on. But also I'd say those are interesting categories for determining disability status. So, yeah.
And I do want to mention, I think the OEHR, they just put out a report, and that is based on a survey, and that does it, and I'll make sure that I send it to Nikki, and she can share it with the group, that gives a much more stark and detailed picture of, you know, the impediments that the disability community faces. And the report just kind of, they got a new person who kind of took the surveys that was done, and it's a pretty compelling report, and I'll make sure that I share it with Nikki so that she can share it with all of you. So we're down to the last slide, and I'm going to hand it over to, it's kind of a, you know, you've listened to me, and thank you for your patience. This is the third presentation, and I will let Nikki sort of sum it up as to where all this is leading us.
I like listening to Uma's presentations, but thank you for letting us get through that as we try to figure out the coverage on them all from some differing notes there. But kind of coming back to fair housing analysis and planning, I know we've all been very excited to kind of have policy discussions, and this is the first area of analysis that we can start to have those policy discussions when we have quorum and at next month's meeting. So I kind of wanted to just touch upon our definitions again, now that we've looked at all of this data. When we're talking about fair housing planning, we talk about barriers and impediments, right? And barriers can be any factor or condition that has that potential to create a disparate impact on a person's housing choice. As impediments are actions, omissions, or decisions by a jurisdiction that effectively restrict a person's housing choice because of race, color, religion, gender, disability, male status, or national origin. Again, those protected classes there. What the CHAS analysis reveals in a kind of summary, and we can continue to expand on the patterns that we saw here today, is that low-income households are disparately impacted by either totally lacking the resources or having inadequate resources to find a housing unit of choice. That our proportion of extremely low-income households has increased at that higher rate than the growth of all households when we looked at that 2011 to 2019 period. While affordability at the city level has continued to decline, which does impact fair housing choice. But low-income households are disproportionately renters and tend to be severely cost-burdened. We recall those tables where Uma had highlighted those figures for us. and low-income households are disproportionately people of color and other protected class status. And so that is where our intersection is there. So I wanted to keep this in mind because we will not be able to do a full policy discussion today. And so we will have a discussion of potential policy recommendations at our next April meeting. And we'll start by pulling off the related recommendations from the 2011 analysis of impediments to fair housing choice that were in relation to these data points. And we can work our way through there to see what is relevant, what may no longer be relevant, where do we feel like there may be tweaking to be made there, or any new potential recommendations. And so that will be the process step for this information moving forward. And some of those recommendations may also not be, they're not gonna be in a completed status. So I'd like to keep that in mind too. There'll be more sections of analysis coming, things like when we're looking at the opportunity mapping, for example, and how that may look next to the spatial maps that we looked at today. And so that's an evolving conversation, but we're gonna start to frame that out based on the data that we saw today.
Nikki, could you maybe take a section of that so that, if we want to respond, we're not talking about the entire report.
No.
We can take little sections for April.
Yeah, so we're working our way through our sections and then we'll do the policy. So that way we can look at the data and then have the policy conversation, data and continue the policy conversation so that they can continue to inform one another as we move throughout the process. I will be sending out that list of those first sets of policy recommendations that are related to the low income household. So there were some things, if you recall, when we reviewed the 2011 report, now that was a couple years ago. So you, I completely understand if you don't.
Still looks in here.
Right, but there were some items around accessible housing for regulated affordable, for rent assistance, some other relevant points that were part of that section of the analysis of impediments.
And can you bring some clarity, because I did comment a lot on that report earlier, years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so we as a group, we're called the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee, but mm-hmm. I have come to see that we don't, that material is given to us. So I don't know, do we just advise on whatever it is you all write? So the new impediments to fair housing, will that be something that's prepared? And then all we do is just advise on it. So my comments that I've made over the years, I'm just wondering, how can I get those integrated? I thought they were good comments. So how can I get those integrated into the report? Some of them are criticisms, I realize. But I think they're very valid. So,
yeah, for the first step, we've only so far covered the demographic summary. So there wasn't really a policy recommendation point, and we do have that will be drafted. In terms of the work I'm following based on the last year's meeting where we voted for the Portland Fair to undergo the voluntary process, which I named the Portland Fair Housing Plan, to just keep it clear from all the federal required planning. And I'm moving through the sections of analysis that were on that original project plan. And so that was the work the committee's taken up, but I've continued to kind of work us there so that we have recommendations there to advocate for.
Oh, this is Mara. I might have a good example that might help a little bit. So at least, because it took me a while to kind of understand how I might honestly utilize this committee, just to be totally honest, and also like what I could contribute. And so one of the specific things on the impediments to affordable housing or accessible housing from 2011 was that they had recommended exploring the definition of an ADA unit. And I know it's kind of small and sort of specific to what I do, but I've done a ton of research on that myself and have been in touch with a lot of different advocates and lawyers and have a really clear picture now of the different definitions of ADA housing. So I'd love to bring that forward because what I'm hoping to do is to see if we can maybe push for some kind of standardization of those ADA definition. So just as an example, that's what I'm hoping to advocate, help use this committee to advocate for specifically is to helping these units be better defined so that people with disabilities can actually find them and they're affordable and they can get into them. So I don't know if that helps at all, but I've heard your comments that you've made on the impediments that, again, I think previous committees have created, and we're just working off of that, those previous comments. But I don't think there's not space for us to bring up like new issues if you think you've brought those up. They should be on the document, right? Because you've been sort of updating that as we go. I know we haven't seen it in a while, though, so that may be part of it.
No, and I can definitely send out that work plan overview again, because I know with our quarterly meeting schedule, kind of, you know, just a few meetings ends up being quite a long time to update everybody in terms of where we are with that. So far we've just had that demographic summary, which due to meeting schedule, we did two demographic summaries. So that was a 6-month period that to be written and drafted into a written format and include all of the data that's already been presented to you. And then we'll continue to build on that. Outside of that, we will continue to hold, opportunities for feedback there, and as well as the public comment process that we'll go through.
I feel like I'm getting instruction here from Mara on what the role of the committee is. And I did address it to both of you, Brianna, and to you, Nikki. I would like to know what our role is. I will give you an example. On that original report, the impediment, I recall seeing something that said, what is the solution, or how can this be resolved? And education was listed.
Mm-hmm.
Now that was 12 years ago, am I right? Are we talking about the same document, education? And in 12 years, we have not educated people, and the segregation in this town has grown. So that's something that I would like to have input on. And I brought it up maybe early on, 2020, when we first began meeting this particular meeting. So, for example, if committee members feel that there are other recommendations beyond just education, is that something that we will be providing or discussing or contributing, or is it something that's going to come out of Portland Housing Bureau or some other committee?
Yeah. Alan has his hand up as well. I'll just do a quick response. And the answer is yes, Barbara. So we'll be starting those policy recommendations piece by piece. So we covered the low income, and that's where those policy discussions will be starting at our April meeting with those relevant. And again, we'll pull out some relevant starting points from the 2011 analysis of impediments. And then we can discuss them, add new potential recommendations, and go through that discussion process to get to a draft set of recommendations, which again may continue to evolve as we move through more analysis and continue to build on those recommendations. And part of that, we do have that education and outreach piece, and we do actually have that in the work plan as well. It comes after the data, though, that we do for low-income households. We do some segregation and integration work. We look at disability access. We do have a few points to get to before we get to education, where that may be a relevant recommendation, or where you may want to get more specific with a recommendation or so forth.
I guess I'm really trying to find out what my role is. I mean, after all these years and all these meetings, and I've been attending this committee even before I became a committee member, you know, and so I want to know what my role is so that I'm not pushing on an issue that is outside my role as a committee member. I think that I would really like more clarification on that. And again, I have referred to that document, and I have made a few, I guess you would call them, criticisms. But to me, looking at it from the point of view of what it is that I'm here for and what it is I hope to accomplish, I feel that some of those statements definitely need to be revised. Is that something that I can participate in? I you know what I'm saying? Brianna, you're
yeah.
nodding.
Yeah, I mean,
Brianna, do you want to use your mic there? That's fine.
And yeah. Introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. Brianne Dedecker, manager of the rental services office. Yes, I mean, this is intended to be an iterative process. So as we revise and go through all the data and look at the reports, the role of committee members is to craft recommendations, work together, and pass recommendations to then provide to other relevant decision makers, the Housing Bureau, to City Council. That's like the intent of the project. We just haven't gotten to those policy recommendation steps yet because we're pretty early on in the process.
Okay. I don't mean to belabor this, but, and this is Barbara Dyer. We have been meeting for 3 years. So I feel it's unclear what my role is here. What you are looking to me to provide or not to provide, what you consider interference or obstruction. I don't know. Words are coming into my mind. Because what I really want is to participate with this committee as it is, as it's designed to be. And I think that's perfect. And if I have other agenda items, I'm working elsewhere on them. I don't need to bring all my agenda items to the Fair Housing Advocacy Committee, for example.
Yeah, and you know, this committee has been meeting for a while. There have been some struggles with the fact that it is only a quarterly advisory body. There have been a couple of months that quorum hasn't been made, so we are a little behind schedule. So I understand that there may be some frustrations around the pace at which this is going or has gone, but we're hoping that now that we're moving into these data presentations and policy recommendations and reviews, that you know, we'll begin to start doing more of this meaty substantive work that sort of calls in all of the expertise that we've gathered in the room.
I do want to be respectful to Alan Lazo, who's had his hand raised, and make sure that anybody else has anything to add online. Sorry, I know sometimes this hybrid environment, I want to make sure we're paying attention to our online participants as well. So if committee members, you have something to add to the conversation, please feel free to raise your hand. And Alan, if you would like to
Thanks, Nikki. I'm fine, actually, because I'm going to steer away from this a little tiny bit. It's kind of related, but not. So certainly, Barbara, if you want more clarification or discussion, I'm happy to let that continue. But either way is fine with me.
I think we have just a few minutes before public comment. So if we have further comments for Dr. Krishnan in relation to the analysis and follow-up information that we may need to inform the policy discussion, I think we should prioritize those questions so we can get that information to you. Thank you, Alan.
Okay. I think the one thing I would say, and this is a little bit of a stretch, but you know, one of the things that we've been looking at, particularly in the advocacy around the new proposed rule, is for jurisdictions that are sort of in line to redo their plans is to potentially look at the proposed 2023 rule and see if there are things that we should be following there in anticipation of that format. So it's this will be like the third shift in this work that we've looked at, but there might be value in looking at potential changes that are there in the way that it's put together. And there, some of the changes are slight. I don't think they're significantly different than the assessment of fair housing, but there are some changes, particularly in format and what we're and kind of the framing of things. So just wanted to throw that out there also for our consideration.
Yes, thank you, Alan. I think there may be a shift in the structure of the plan in response to that. And I tried to touch on that a little bit during the staff update. While we're still going through the public comment period with HUD, I don't want to make those calls and announce that any structural change at this point, but that could definitely happen. Either way, for the purposes of this body, it will still be going through the process of data and policy recommendations, but the how we approach that work or the specific areas of analysis may change once those rules are finalized. Thank you, Alan, for that comment. That's good to keep in mind as well with Barbara's comments. We have a few minutes left. Do any committee persons have additional questions or comments for Dr. Krishnan?
Nikki, this is Leslie. Would it be okay if I made a comment?
Of course. Hello, Leslie. Could you briefly introduce yourself for folks that may not be familiar?
Sure. Hello, everyone. I'm Leslie Goodlow. I'm the Equity and Business Operations Manager for the Portland Housing Bureau, and I'm currently the executive team sponsor for EPAC while we search for Matthew's replacement. And I just want to speak a little bit to some of the questions around what the purpose of the committee is. First of all, I hope that there's a charter. I've not seen it, but I hope that there is one, and everybody that's on the committee has seen it and read it. The second thing is that all of our committees are advisory to the Bureau specifically and to the director, unless there's something in their charter that says that they can make recommendations to City Council. So I think there sounds to be some confusion about who or where recommendations can be made and who those recommendations go to. So Nikki and Breon, if somebody could send me over the charter at some point so I can look at it and see what's in there. But, you know, I understand that the confusion about what your role is, where, you know, we have five advisory groups where we used to only have one, which was PHAC. And now that we have fives, the role of each kind of overlaps. And one of the things we're trying to make sure is that everybody has clear guidance around where their role, where they begin and end, and where the other committees begin and end, so that we don't, so we do don't create more confusion of what we're asking people to do since you're volunteers. So I just wanted to put that out there. I hear the concerns. I will work with Nikki and Breon to make sure that we can be as clear as possible about the role of FHAC in the scope of the whole scope of what PHB does.
Great. Thank you, Leslie. I appreciate you. Okay, it is 4:16 and we have four community members that indicated they'd like to offer public testimony. We have about 15 minutes scheduled for public testimony. So if you could try to keep that in mind for those that are providing testimony to keep that under 4 minutes would be greatly appreciated. When I call on you, feel free to unmute and address the committee. Angie Egan. Angie, a moment. Okay, Linnea Ballmer. Stephanie Gracie.
Yes.
Stephanie, you are a new committee person, and I think on the registration you had indicated that you would like to offer public testimony, which you're welcome to do. Did you intend to offer public testimony at today's meeting?
No, I think I clicked the wrong box, but I'm very excited to be here.
Great.
Testimony submitted.
Officially recorded. Thank you, Stephanie. Tiffany Graven, apologies, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce your name, Tiffany. Okay, well, turns out we do not have public testimony to be given today. Maybe some folks were not able to attend, but we always want to ensure that we are meeting that agenda time and offering that space. Okay, our final agenda item is to discuss public comments. this is going to be led by Mara Romero. She's on our community engagement subcommittee, and they've been talking about what is the role of public comment? How would we respond to folks? Do we have any concerns, and how do we frame that up for the public? So I will pass it over to Mara.
Thank you so much. And I will admit I'm a little topsy-turvy now, because when you said we had four people signed up, I was like, well, maybe we don't need to work on public comment then. But obviously we do. So so Barb and I are on the sort of like community engagement subcommittee, which we've spent a lot of time just trying to decide what that means exactly. And so, you know, we've had good discussions there. And one of the things we talked about maybe kind of focusing on for community engagement is trying to encourage people to offer public comment and to be able to get more voices into this room, letting us know what's going on that can actually inform our decisions that we're making. So we wanted to let you guys know that we're working on that. That's what we've kind of picked to focus on as a subcommittee, at least for now. And we wondered about what the general thoughts were around this, if you thought this was a good idea, or if you have any experience, if there's anything you'd like to lend the subcommittee around this issue. And then this is kind of going into another part of it, which is that if you've ever, you know, sat and listened to testimony, especially if we're encouraging it, it can be hard. And so we also talked a lot about trauma and being trauma informed, and how both the other folks who may be coming to offer testimony, people sitting, you know, on the committee themselves, how they may process, having to listen to repeated stories of fair housing violations or that such thing. So maybe Alan or FHCO might have some tips or techniques or something for us that they utilize in their work and their listening techniques. Thanks for the smile, Alan. And one of the things also that we were talking about is, you know, how we can basically help people with the public comment. You know, how can we work with organizations or whatever we might be able to do to get out there and let people know that we would like to hear from our community? You know, who are the gatekeepers? Who do other people trust that could maybe help them write up some testimony or something? And maybe that could be part of how we think about the trauma stewardship. And lastly, I mentioned that there's a great trauma stewardship training by Laura Lipinski Scoot, I believe her name is. And it's just good for all, I think, people who interact with the public and have to listen to a lot of hard stories. So I thought potentially if PHB was interested, we'd be interested in a trauma stewardship course. I think that was all the notes that Nikki very beautifully put together. Thank you. I'll end it there.
Do we have any committee members with additional thoughts on Mara and Barbara's work on the subcommittee, public comment role, purpose in general? Barbara?
Hi, it's Barbara Geyer. Sorry, folks, but most of that, I didn't realize that we had come to any understanding or agreement. I thoroughly opposed public comment. I have done that not only in the outreach committee, but in the main committee meetings, as I recall. Again, it's years, so I get my committees mixed up. But since we offer them nothing, you ask a person who is in such dire crisis and in danger, endangered in their housing, to come forward and speak when we offer them nothing. So that's my position. And again, the groups that I am most concerned with, that I'm working with, that I feel need help the most, that are covered by laws and the laws are disregarded. These people, they are the lowest resource people. They, if they lose their housing, they have nothing. And I'm not speaking as someone who's sort of up here, kind of intellectually discussing this issue. I've lived it as well. So I am living racial discrimination and other discriminations as we speak. So that issue of public comment has been left up in the air. And I do find it interesting because I have attended the Portland the Resident Services Committee meetings for over 4 years. And I've commented to them and to others about public comment that comes into their room and what they've done about it. And I've tried to encourage them to create a safer place. And then I noticed in the North Northeast, there were people coming in and you can kind of feel how they're very troubled by something when they do public comment, but they can't identify what it is. And I know that feeling very well. Because when it comes to racial discrimination, harassment, aggression, hatred, it's not something that you can just say, ah, that's what it is. You just feel it, you internalize it. And it's just sort of there, and it covers your whole being and your life. And there's a fear factor that just won't go away. And I see Alan's nodding his head, and even Alan has said that many people cannot come forward. They don't even file complaints because they are so endangered in their housing that any retaliation, and it does exist, they can be one of those people now that we're talking about where we're not giving them any more tents and blankets. We're not, because we don't want any more of those people on the streets. So what is a person to do? And so in these committees, I thought we would look for ways that we could enforce the law. And I'm still working on that. And I don't think, I've changed my mind on a lot of issues. I just don't think education is correct anymore. I used to think that, but I don't, no longer. And because it's been out there and it's available, but this segregation that's occurring in our city that exists, it's there because of deeply felt animosity towards certain groups of people and an unwillingness to live alongside of them. You know, but they are covered under the law. So there's the dilemma. Anyway, that's my thoughts on, those are my thoughts on public housing. But if we have nothing to offer them, we cannot, I mean, all we're gonna do is put your arm around and say, you know, that's just terrible. They've isolated you in your own building. You can't even walk in and out of the building without looks of callous looks and stares. I mean, HUD writes about this extensively, that this occurs in HUD buildings, harassment from other tenants who feel that they are able to do that to their neighbors. And they've identified certain people. And if you are a person of color, as I am, It is very easy to identify me as one of them, not one of us. And I've been reading a lot of scientific material, and apparently our brains are kind of hardwired for this us versus them feeling, which is really, really, really upsetting to me that I didn't realize that. But the material I've been reading kind of goes to explain why people change, political thing like Sarajevo and Bosnia. What happened there? They studied that, where people used, at one point were neighbors and friends and community members, and then they, these two states formed, and then they hated each other and they killed each other and they had no mercy for each other. And apparently humans are kind of hardwired. So we have to overcome that. But we have laws 55 years ago, the federal government passed laws that said this type of behavior is illegal. So here we are. Thank you. Sorry, didn't mean to keep going on.
This is Mara again. I just wanted to say to Barb, I apologize if I didn't communicate your thoughts from that last meeting appropriately, but I think we were actually kind of saying the same thing, and I really want to make sure I clarify that, which is that we're not okay with people feeling that way. We want people to be brave and to figure out ways to talk about what they're experiencing. Maybe this isn't the right forum, but But I think that's more what we spend our time in subcommittee talking about, is that people are afraid, and we get that. So what can we do as a committee? How can we bring people to the table to share their stories in a way where they won't face retaliation? Because yes, absolutely, it exists. The laws are, I call it rights v. reality, to the people that I work with. But the reality of it is, you know, my understanding at least was that one thing we might be able to do for community engagement at least is to figure out if we can get some of these voices into our committee, whether they're anonymous testimony provided by an agency or whatever it is, but just getting more public comment and hopefully in a safe way where people felt that they were doing it. And I know you have a lot of frustrations over people putting out a lot of energy and not a lot happening, but that really is bureaucracy, right? So anyway, I would just encourage you to remember that you're doing good work, but it is a little incremental in this system and in the law. It takes time for things to get better. That's all I know. And you've been doing it a long time. So that's my only comment there.
I got to do a quick insert here. Thank you, Mara. Everybody looks at me and says, oh gosh, Barbara Geyer is this really old woman. But guess what? I was there. So in 1968, I was alive. Was I an adult? I was there. I remember what it took to pass that law, the 1964 law, the 1968, and then 20 years later, the disability section added to fair housing. So you see me as old, and you say, oh, Barbara has a lot of frustration. How many lifetimes is it going to take before we actually start focusing in? And I understand new people coming up, new generation. It's like, oh, good, let's talk about fair housing. But I'm saying, let's remember the past well. And that's where the urgency is. It's not like it just started. 55 years is a very long time. And I am in real estate, two states, 45 years. So I have practiced fair housing my entire life. It's second nature to me. And I'm going to impose upon you. I'm going to tell a real quick story. I used to sell new homes, big projects. Well, I had one customer come in, and he looked to me like he might be Asian descent. He bought a condo, and I made sure all of his rights were protected, including his ancestry and whatever else. I can't remember. Once he became an owner, he came to me and he wanted me to find a renter for his condo. But he said, no Chinese. I said, oh, I can't. What? I can't do that. He had a very valid reason, though, but that doesn't change the fact I could not say no Chinese need apply. He didn't want Chinese because he thought the cooking got into the drywall and had made the like a restaurant and made it smell, and you can't get that smell out. And that was his thinking. Well, it sounded valid, but it was a violation of fair housing. So I told him no. A year later, when he went to sell his property, I didn't get the listing. So, I mean, when you practice fair housing, sometimes you don't make money. Sometimes you have to leave money on the table. And that's the real estate industry. That's the reality of what we do when we practice fair housing. So, anyway. No more. I won't say anymore.
I just want to refocus us a little bit on the public comment discussion, because I know that Mara was interested, and also I wanted to bring up as a common issue in public comment on public advisory bodies, as you all think about your initial impressions and thoughts, is that, you know, this is an advisory body to the Housing Bureau and not any kind of enforcement body. And that is something that often can be a misunderstanding. And, you know, I just wanted to point that out. I know in other advisory bodies, you know, sometimes folks go to these thinking that there is some type of enforcement action that they can access through giving public comment at these types of meetings, and maybe thinking not quite understanding the scope of work and the role of the committee. And so I just wanted to kind of highlight that as well, just in my time at Portland Housing Bureau, that is kind of a consistent thing of a need of framing. And I was hoping that Maura could kind of get us there. So I want to refocus us just real quick on public comment with those things in mind, that this is an advisory body that's looking at very high level policy recommendations and data analysis. And so when folks come in to give public comment, what does that look like? Is there any way that we can mitigate or manage expectations, encourage public comment from folks in the community that ensure that they can be heard?
This is Mara again. I've got a thought that potentially we could do some thinking around as we move into the impediments, and we maybe do identify a policy that we're interested in maybe advising on. I think I said that right. Then we could maybe work with organizations, and I don't want to put more on these organizations. I know do so much good work. Really, I do deeply understand that, but maybe helping them get a template draft together. I know that's how I do my best advocacy, is when someone sends me an example I could use to reference from, and a specific topic. So a call for people who are low income on a voucher and are not able to find housing, you know, whatever. So, and then maybe making sure that we talk to those people before they give public comment, not us, but just a gatekeeper, something that can explain, like, don't release any personal information, too personal of information, you know, try to keep things general. There are general guidelines on offering testimony if you're a vulnerable person, and we could kind of consult those. But yeah, those are the kinds of things that came up, and thank you, Nikki, for kind of circling back around to that, because yeah, that really is, I guess, the intent of what we're trying to figure out, is like, how do we look at public testimony for honestly all of the Portland housing programs, but specifically what we have control over, this program, this committee, to get people more engaged. Because honestly, if I ask someone on any given day that I work with that's maybe got a voucher from Home Forward or something, they don't know nothing about this committee. They may not even understand what fair housing is, except they have to sign some darn form when they're trying to get a place. So that's all I'm saying, is that I think education could be many different things, and it could be maybe just figuring out how to get more people involved with the concept of fair housing. I know, Alan, you're shaking your head because this is really your whole deal. But, you know, again, I know we do different things, and this is really about the Portland Housing Bureau's, you know, like policies. But yeah, it just seems like we have some natural partners there that we could tap to inform our committee in a safe way, if that makes sense. And I don't know if anybody has any other thoughts on that, or any other organizations that you could think of that might be good for that kind of thing. But yeah.
Ellen has his hand raised there. Alan, did you have some thoughts to add there?
I have lots of thoughts, but I thought I'd let other committee members answer Mara's question if they wanted to. I think that's a great question about, you know, groups that we could reach out to that have intersections with the work that we're doing here. And I think this is a really fantastic discussion. I think the community engagement piece is really valuable. So I'll come back to that if there are other committee members that have thoughts about what Mara was talking about.
You, I see your hands raised.
Hi, yeah, this is Yung from Community Alliance of Tenants, and I am in, you know, total agreement that education, I mean, it's hard for me not to look at it from that perspective, because that's my whole wheelhouse, but that education is one of the, you know, steps towards kind of helping people just have the tools that they need in order to feel confident and comfortable in doing whatever they need to do, whether that's asserting their rights, whether they're getting ready to give public testimony for the first time. And And I think, you know, I think it's been touched on a little bit before that there are a number of organizations that, you know, many of us work for that have our different strategies of how to gather, you know, a collective of folks to feel like they can engage in these processes. And I think that something that Mara had touched on, you know, I think kind of, you know, I'm not sure if that's the right term, but kind of like a toolkit that's provided by the city, you know, for something that is happening that is already translated into many different languages is a really great starting point for any of the organizations or community groups that want to be involved. Like some of that, you know, some of that legwork has already been done. And then, you know, it gets distributed to the community or organizations, then we can take that and, you know, work with it however we want to work with it, or give it our own flavor and our own style. And of course, that when it's based on going out, you know, and thinking about reaching out to organizations to do some of that work, that trust building is already there. So, you know, folks might feel more comfortable because they may have received some level of, you know, education or training or, you know, workshops that they've been to prepare for other events. So I don't know how involved we would want to be with, but I'd love to see, you know, what other groups are doing to train folks to get ready for that. And I think that that piece of the trauma-informed approach is really important. And the recognition that people who need to, a part of their responsibility and role to listen to those stories over and over again, you know, I think about that in the daily work, but also just the folks that work at the city and that have to, that they need to listen and process that too, that as us as an advisory committee, and then the folks at the city, that you all have something or provide for yourselves and for us too, training on how to process that and deal with listening to that and that kind of secondary trauma effect that it might have. But those are just my thoughts for now. Thank you.
I'll just do a quick response. I'm unaware of any kind of toolkit or kind of public facing the outlines of public comment at Portland Housing Bureau advisory bodies. I do recall at one point there was, you know, a discussion on another advisory body about having, you know, a list of resources available for folks that maybe do think that they're approaching some sort of enforcement body. I don't know if that was fully implemented because I feel like maybe it hit right about COVID. But you know, I can check and see if anything had been prepared for that or if there's any other kind of already existing tools or documents or anything that was intended for members of the public giving public comment. But I'm unaware of anything that would be a toolkit in the way that you're describing it. I just wanted to add that comment.
Nikki, this is Mara. Are you, oh, never mind, I'll say my question. Okay, I'll ask. I just wasn't sure. So I remember you mentioning the resources, and I think it was like in order to make sure that we had something available for people who disclosed something that maybe we wanted to make sure they didn't leave without getting some resources. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that was probably what I was referring to. You know, it was folks that were maybe coming in crisis to the Rental Services Commission or something similar.
It was RSC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, and there had been discussion at some point, you know, about whether there was a resource list or, you know, some sort of follow-up to ensure that that community member was connected with more appropriate resources, because an advisory body, while hearing public comment can be very informative during policy discussions and, you know, adding more voices to the table, again, is not responsive to folks that
are looking for legal assistance, housing assistance, rent assistance, et cetera.
No false hope.
Okay. I'm happy to contribute more if we have time.
Yeah, if we continue on the public comment, yeah, that would be great.
All right, I'd love to. Thank you. This is Barbara Geyer again. And I said earlier that I don't feel education, it should be, the answer should be in the impediments report anymore. I just don't think that that's the answer for a lot of reasons. But when it comes to CAT, for example, hi, Dom, and I'm a member of CAT. I joined just because I support anybody that helps, but they are geared to, and I've been involved with CAT on and off for many, many, many years, on and off. And they're very involved with know your rights, know your rights. And I used to think also that that was probably correct, know your rights. And I should go out, and I even suggested at a community meeting to Portland Housing Bureau that we do a tenant-focused class on fair housing, tenant-focused. And of course that hasn't happened. I wanted to teach that. I thought that would be really good. But what group of people, first I should say, I know the law, it hasn't helped me much. It doesn't, if someone does not want to rent to me or sell to me, the fact that I know the law, it does not help. So I feel like we have a long way to go to get that point across. What can Barbara Geyer do if a person says, oh, the apartment has been rented, or they simply don't answer the door when they see me walk up, or, you know, my offer gets put in a do not present file or some other illegal thing? So I don't know that that's the answer. And what other group of people has to learn the law, advocate for themselves, advocate well, speak well, be able to be an attorney when you are one of those very low income people, you know, making, what's the number, less than 18,000 or 25,000 a year or something, whatever that number is, that group has to somehow do all those things. They need to advocate them for themselves. They need to, okay, this is against the law. Harassment on the basis of the color of my skin is against the law. And so I need to understand how I can stop that. If you're buying a house, you usually have a real estate agent. You don't even have to know the law. You don't, you know, you rely upon groups of people who are committed to helping you through the process. It's the most amazing thing. When you start talking about tenants and you talk about very low income tenants, it's a whole different world. Although I was reminded and presented with this very interesting case, here was one attorney who just got plastered. He tried to assert his housing rights, and I read the case and I thought, he's right, but he lost an appeal, you know, and he's an attorney. So I think our task is daunting. And I sit and I think and I write and I read and I talk and I try to understand what solutions would look like. But I do need us to move on beyond education and learning what the law is and advocating for ourselves. You know, I think tenants need to assert their housing rights, but they need help doing so. Thanks.
Thank you, Barbara. It's 4:47. You know, I'm not sure that we have more on the public comment discussion point further. So Mara, I've got some notes. I'm sure you've got some notes. We can bring that back to the community engagement subcommittee. I think the next steps were to kind of hear what was said today and come up with a proposal. So I'm sure you and Barbara can work on that in the next meeting. And thank you for the comments that were provided by committee members in regards to that subject. And if it is ready. We had this rescheduled, so it's quite quick. We can possibly pick up the conversation a little bit in April or July at the latest.
Yeah, I appreciate us bringing it up. And honestly, if any committee members have other ideas for community engagement, obviously the subcommittee is open ears. We just thought it might be good to, you know, again, pick something to focus on that we could figure out a good solution to, but we're obviously open. And I'm excited to hear what the policy subcommittee might be doing too. So thanks.
Great. So with that, I'll just give us 10 minutes of our day back. Thank you, everyone. We will follow up with the more information regarding the income bands for national statistics or similar cities that Uma had mentioned. And I'll send that out. Also keep eyes out for information on the Fair Housing Month proclamation. And I will invite you all to attend in person or stream. Again, that would be Wednesday, April 5th. And I will see you all next month. Thank you so much.
And then we can do public comment about the agenda item for Fair Housing.
Would have to be after our next subcommittee meeting, maybe. Yeah. I don't know, but
I think we'll have to define it there.
Yeah, because otherwise it might be a similar conversation if we don't bring anything new.
Individual.
Thanks all.
Okay. Oh. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you.